Calling the Environment Policy and Oversight Committee to order. First thing on the agenda, we do need to approve the March 3rd meeting minutes. And Representative McNamara.
Oh, I'd love to move them, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative McNamara moves the meeting minutes of March 3rd. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails and minutes are adopted. Today we have Representative Frank Hornstein with us. He's going to be presenting us House File 898. And Representative Bigham. House File 898, did you want to say?
Yeah, I'd like to move 898 for Mr. Representative Frank Hornstein.
Okay, Representative Bigham moves House File 898 to be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations.
That's my motion.
So, thank you. And Representative Hornstein, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members. It's good to be here. And we are talking today about House File 898, and what I'll do is just give a very brief overview, go through the sections, and then we have a number of testifiers. And I guess, Mr. Chair and members, one of the advantages of having an informational hearing on the broad concept as we had jointly with the Transportation Committee last week is that we can pare down the testimony, because I think a lot of the high points were made last week to this committee. But to review, this bill comes out of the
And maybe Representative Hornstein, I know you have an amendment as well.
Oh yes,
you want to have that moved?
I have an amendment.
The very beginning here. And
I
will move
D-7.
Okay. And you also have a DE-8 amendment. Does that supersede the DE-7, or is that in addition to?
I'm not aware of, but I don't know if Mr. Evos is. I know there was some discussions even just a few minutes ago.
Right. There is a DE-8 amendment that does supersede the DE-7, Mr. Chair.
Okay, then we'll move the DE-8 then.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Hornstein. I will move the DE-8 amendment to get it in the shape and form that the author would like. I don't know if Representative Hornstein, you just want to say briefly what it is and go on.
Mr. Chair and members, as you may imagine, this bill has attracted some interest among a number of stakeholders, and we are trying to meet some of the concerns as we go along. Particularly in the Senate, there was a long discussion about environmental review as it pertains to agricultural interests, feedlots, ethanol plants, etc. This removes that. That was the main highlight of the amendment. There's some effective date changes that it amends. And I would just say, while we're on the topic, Mr. Chair, that it is a work in progress. We're having ongoing meetings, particularly with the League of Cities, the Metropolitan Council, and those will be continuing. And so we've tried to meet some of those concerns as well with this amendment.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Hornstein. Again, this is in the shape that the author would like. I will renew the motion that the DE-8 amendment be passed. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. And Representative Hornstein to the bill as amended.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair and members. Just briefly, the goal of this bill is to look at the relationship between land use and greenhouse gas emission vehicle miles traveled. And the nexus as well with energy use in the transportation sector. Mr. Chair and members, 25% of greenhouse gas emissions come from the transportation sector. It's a significant source of greenhouse gases. The lion's share, three-quarters of that, comes from automobile and other vehicle emissions. And so this is a real effort to take a look at this particular problem and respond to the Next Generation Energy Act provision, where we had a climate change advisory group formed, appointed by the governor, and there was a pretty strong recommendation in that report to take a look at the nexus between land use and transportation. We've had several studies, Mr. Chair and members, that have confirmed that this is one of the single most important things one can do to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from the transportation sector. And I know this isn't always the hook for some members, greenhouse gas reduction, but when we reduce greenhouse gases, we're also reducing our dependence on oil, foreign and domestic. Our oil consumption in the United States is projected to go up to 66% within the next few years of foreign sources. Some of that from countries that are not terribly friendly to us, and I think that then also becomes a national security as well as an environmental issue. So I think that's another rationale for the bill. Finally, in terms of the overview, we view this as also helpful in terms of reducing public costs. Members, we're seeing more and more development, of course, out at the fringe of the region, and when we get that, we're spending more on highways, we're more on sewer and water infrastructure, wastewater treatment facilities, sewer interceptors. This is some of the most expensive public infrastructure. And so when we deal with land use planning and wed it to greenhouse gas and oil consumption reductions, we then can save some money on public infrastructure costs. So in terms of the bill, members, we have just had Section 1 as introductory language that kind of confirms some of the studies that have been referenced earlier. Section 2 just deals with wetlands. We've been working with Bowser on this. It just specifies that carbon sequestration values is an existing statute. Wetlands are, of course, a very important way in which we reduce carbon in our environment. We set up a grant program to help communities adapt to some of the provisions in the bill, particularly as they relate to planning. Section 4 is the section I referenced earlier on environmental review, and we have really honed that down to mainly transportation-related development projects, many of which are already under existing environmental impact statement guidelines. These are some of the larger projects, so we're not adding to environmental review in terms of the kinds of projects, simply saying that they ought to be looking at projected energy use and greenhouse gas emissions, et cetera. And this is also the section of the bill that we responded to a number of the concerns from the agricultural community. Sections 5 and 6 deal with school siting requirements, having some more local control over this. We've had a lot of concern around the state about large schools being sited somewhat distant from towns in which the students are attending. And this is also covered in Sections 5 and 6. We have vehicle mile traveled reduction goals for MnDOT. These are very much similar to those that are enunciated in the MCAG report. And then Sections 9 through 12 deal with metro area planning, and you'll probably hear more about this. The main goal here is to include these greenhouse gas reduction goals in the comprehensive planning process that cities in the metro area are required to do under statute to the Met Council. So, members and Mr. Chair, that's pretty much the bill. We have one small appropriation in Section 13 related to some guidelines that we want the Center for Transportation Studies at the U of M to provide, and it's a small study that would be funded through livable communities grants, which are already accounted for. These are not new monies. They're monies within a program of the Metropolitan Council. So that's the bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. And we have testifiers, Ms. J. Drake Hamilton. Nice to have you here today. Please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is J. Drake Hamilton. I am Science Policy Director at Fresh Energy. Fresh Energy is a private nonprofit that was formed in 1990 to advocate for smart energy policies for the state of Minnesota, ones that would increase economic development, get us healthier economies, healthier communities, cleaner air, cleaner water, and move us to energy independence. And my role is manager of the Global Warming Solutions Program, so we're very interested in efforts that will greatly reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. As you know, in May of 2007, the legislature passed the Next Generation Energy Act in recognition of the implications that global warming may have on the economy, environment, and quality of life right here in Minnesota. And the law set out some goals across the economy of Minnesota, at least 15% reduction in emissions from 2005 levels by 2015, 30% reductions by 2025, and 80% reductions by 2050. Right around the same time, Governor Pawlenty, recognizing that he was about to sign this bill, I think, created his climate change advisory group. He appointed 56 Minnesotans from most or all of the industries around the state, Minnesota citizens, and myself, and the purpose of the group was, quote, to identify, evaluate, and recommend to me and the Minnesota legislature a range of actions that, consistent with the state's need for economic vitality, will substantially reduce Minnesota's greenhouse gas emissions. And this is called the Climate Action Plan. And remember that what we need to do is take greenhouse gas emissions down from a 2005 level of almost 157 million metric tons of CO2, down by about 30% by 2025. So indeed, the Governor's Climate Change Advisory Group recommended a suite of 46 policy actions that, if fully enacted and implemented across the state, would allow us to achieve the 2025 goal. So we could take all of these actions, or if we didn't take some of them, we would need to substitute other actions that would get us just as much reduction at the same or lower cost. Among those actions was the recognition of a set of actions that said, we really need to make sure that Minnesotans have more attractive options for getting around other than having to drive most places alone. So for those Minnesotans who want to reduce their vehicle miles traveled, providing those more attractive options. They include improved land use planning and development strategies, expanding transit around the state, making bicycling and pedestrian infrastructure more friendly to users, and workplace tools to encourage carpooling, transit ridership, and bicycling. All of those recommendations had unanimous support from the Climate Change Advisory Group, and all of them would achieve significant carbon reductions at net savings, to large net savings for Minnesotans. For those reasons, Fresh Energy heartily supports House File 898 because we need to take the responsible steps for reducing our emissions. Without enacting the measures in this bill, we believe we cannot meet our Next Generation Energy Act goal. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Hamilton. And are there questions for either Ms. Hamilton or Representative Hornstein at this point? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony. And we have Director John Jasky from the Board of Water and Soil Resources. Is he here? I guess he's not here. So we'll move on to the next testifier, Mr. John Wells from the EQB. Welcome, Mr. Wells.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm John Wells, the staff with the Environmental Quality Board. And Representative Hornstein is going to make me be ambidextrous here.
Well,
so,
no, I mean,
actually, I think I can do this.
This is just always split up the left.
I want to drive you away. Although I might need Mr. Bigley to get this thing aligned. I'm going to do a PowerPoint if that hasn't been clear. I think I'm going to do a PowerPoint. There we go. Thank you very much. Sorry for that.
No problem.
Well, I'm going to give you a little Environmental Review 101, and I have to qualify from the start that I'm not the EQB's Environmental Review expert. They're on the road right now in Brainerd. We're in the middle of a hearing process to amend the Environmental Review rule. But I'll give you at least my 10 cents on it. First of all, who is the Environmental Quality Board? We don't always come before this committee, so it's just a little quick review of it. We're nine commissioners, and only commissioners can serve on the board. They can't send alternates. Five citizen members and a chair appointed and serving at the pleasure of the governor. And at the present time, the chair is the Commissioner of Agriculture, so there's a dual role that Commissioner Hugerson plays. Our mission, these are five of the main things that ECB is responsible for.
I'll just mention the second one is the oversight of the environmental review program, so that's what I want to mention today. We do other things like the state water plan, which is due next September, actually. Convene environmental congresses, ensure compliance with state environmental policy, the Environmental Policy Act, which is one for the some basics on environmental review. It applies to projects that have potential or may have potential for significant environmental effects. That's the whole point, is to understand what the environmental implications are for a project that might have that potential. It's intended to disclose information through a systematic public process. It works in conjunction with permits and other kinds of other forms of approval. The basic law is in 116D04, section 04. The oversight is assigned to the Environmental Quality Board to do the rule that governs the process and provide all the materials and consultation and advice with the people who are engaged in that process. And that rule number is Chapter 4410, which describes what projects need review and how that kind of review should be done for those projects. EQB provides standard forms, guidance, documents, and advice on a daily basis to citizens throughout the state and local officials, and even occasionally state staff. Since 1982, this has been a decentralized process. It used to be previous to 1982 that EQB did every single review in the state. And there was some merit to that, but they decided it was too much and it would be better to bring it closer to the people. So we created through rule in 1982 the idea, the concept of responsible governmental unit. And that depends on the project. And it depends, as you'll see here, our rules specify how you identify that RGU. And normally it's the unit with the most direct authority over the project. For example, on a subdivision, it would be local government that's approving that subdivision. On an ethanol production facility, it happens to be the Pollution Control Agency. The RGU, given the EQB overarching rule, the RGU decides what needs review, what information to collect, and when that review is complete. They can talk and get assistance from EQB, but they have to make their own decisions on that process. Decisions are appealable only in district court, and they must be filed, however, to be appealed within 30 days of the decision. So what's covered? Environmental review applies to projects that, there's a three-step test here. They require at least one governmental approval or aid decision. They must result in typical manipulation of the environment, and they involve future action. Obviously, you can't do the review if it's already happened, if the project's already been completed or actually initiated. The whole point of the connection between permits and environmental review is, number one, is to better inform those decisions in the permitting process. Final approvals and construction must await until environmental review is completed. So you can't start a project until you've completed environmental review. And you can't actually have any kind of formal approval until you've completed environmental review. And the test of that has been widely considered to be any significant decision that a local government or state agency makes. Environmental review is not an approval process. What we mean by that, environmental review does not result in the approval or disapproval of a project. It's just an information generation activity. It does not in itself impose conditions on projects, although it could lead to conditions being imposed through a permitting process. And it doesn't change the authority of local government. The other thing that can happen, we have a structure of environmental assessment worksheets and thresholds and categories that require EAWs, exemptions to those categories and so forth. Other than exemptions, though, you can also have EAWs and environmental review triggered by citizen petitions, which is kind of a nice democratic process. And the citizens would have to present material evidence that the project may have potential for those significant environmental effects. And it must be signed by 25 individuals. They can be from Timbuktu, but it must be 25 individuals. EQB staff verifies the signatures that they are legitimate and so forth, and we trigger the process once we receive the petition. We define the RGU that will get the petition. We send it to the RGU, and they make the decision on whether or not to do the EAW. They still don't have to. So what are environmental assessment worksheets? Well, there are 31 questions involved in those, and they really get at the project description, the environmental setting, the potential environmental impact, and even possible mitigation measures to those to that project. The EAW does not get into alternative projects. That's only if you do an EIS, environmental impact statement. The whole point is to gather the information needed to decide whether you should do an EIS. They're not supposed to be entities of their own goal. I mean, the EAW is to help inform decision makers on whether they should do something further. It's evolved in a little bit different way, but that was the original intent. The project proposer supplies the basic data, and the RGU, that responsible governmental unit, takes that basic data and prepares and approves the EAW. So benefits, better informed permit decisions. This is a very citizen-friendly process. It's kind of a one-stop process to voice all environmental concerns, including those that go beyond specific narrow permitting requirements. And in that sense, it's a safety net for a whole variety of issues, including issues maybe we haven't considered before that affect the environment. The Environmental Quality Board provides assistance through that website. There's a whole series of guidance documents on that website, available on the website. There's an environmental review hotline, and the real experts are Greg Downing and John Larson at the UCB, and those, I've given you their email addresses. They also have phone numbers. And there's my name and number if you need to contact me. So any questions?
Any questions? And what were the number, do you have the number again of the, how many environmental assessment worksheets are done?
Yes, again, and I don't know, did you get a handout on that or not? I don't know if that was made available to you or not. There were, last year, 110 were done throughout the state. 70 were, the RGU was the local government in 70 cases, and in 40 cases, the RGU was a state agency.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate your testimony.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Hornstein.
Dean Pulaski knew I was. Representative Pulaski knew I was doing the CPG area set with me, but I do have a very short oral amendment which I neglected to share with you that I'd like to move up as well to get the bill in the shape I'd like it.
Sure.
My apologies to you, Mr. Chair, and the committee.
No apologies.
I think it more accurately reflects some of the conversations we had ongoing with the League of Cities and other stakeholders, and this is on. Line 3.14. Well, actually, 3.13.
Okay.
That's page 3. Strike, analyze, and substitute, consider. And then on 3.14, period after emissions, and then delete and alternatives and mitigation measures to reduce those emissions.
Okay.
And again, I think that more accurately summarizes at least one conversation that was had several days ago.
Okay. So. Well, I will move the oral amendment for our Representative Hornstein on line 3.13, strike analyze and replace it with consider. And on line 3.14, put a period after emissions and strike and alternatives and mitigation measures to reduce those emissions.
That's correct.
Everybody understand the amendment? Okay, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails and amendment is adopted. And we will move on to the next expert, and Director John Jaffe from Bowser. Welcome, Director.
Good afternoon. John Jassy, Director of Board of Water and Soil Resources. Mr. Chairman, I've been asked to simply speak to simply one line in this bill, line 2.13.
Is that 2.13 or 3.13?
I believe it's 2.13.
2.13.
2.13, which says that adds carbon sequestration to the list of functions that are part of... Okay, I'm sorry, I must have an older version of the bill.
Right, we're on the DE8.
I apologize.
And I think it'd be line 2.2, where it says carbon sequestration and...
Mr. Chairman, that's correct, I'm on the words haven't changed, but it's a different line, yes, 2.2. My comments on that are simply that this provision of statute was established for the purpose of serving the Wetland Conservation Act, which is our wetland protection program in the state that's been in law since the early 1990s. This addition to this provision of statute would simply use a method that we already have in place, known as MNRAM, to assess our wetlands that are being considered for impacts and replacement. We have a no net loss policy which says that the wetland impacts are replaced by wetlands of equal or greater function. In a practical way, that's done not by assessing each of these functions individually, but by simply looking at the wetland type, the plant communities, and the water regime in that wetland, and replacing as close as possible with another one that's similar plant communities and similar water regime. So a deeper water wetland with aquatic fringe would be replaced by a similar wetland. We would get similar functions and being mitigated. The one case where this would be brought into more detailed consideration would be when a local government, a county, city, watershed, et cetera, were to adopt a wetland protection plan of their own making, which then allows them to, where they choose to identify special wetland characteristics with special protection measures, they adopt above and beyond the state standards. They could use this simply to say that's what's going to be considered as one of the functions that wetland provides that they're evaluating. So overall, it would have a negligible effect in terms of practice. I think that there's more information I can provide you with in terms of research. Representative Wagenius and Representative Hansen earlier this year asked for a summary of the research on that. I do not have that with me. I can provide that to the committee, which would give you some references you could look at that talk about the details. On average, and this is a big average, on a per acre basis, wetlands restorations would sequester 3 tons of carbon per acre based on some Iowa State University research. So that's just a ballpark number, but it depends a great deal on the characteristics of the wetland and the water regime in that wetland. So that's my testimony, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you, Director Jaffe. And any questions at all for the director? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And just a reminder to turn off cell phones. We are getting a little bit of feedback here again. Next on the list, let's see what we have. Okay, Mr. John Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, committee. And thank you, Representative Hornstein, for introducing this bill. My name is John Bailey. I'm with Thousand Friends of Minnesota. We're a statewide membership organization working communities all over the state promoting a better way to grow. We call this bill Building Sensible Communities, and I just wanted to note that this is one of the priority initiatives of the Minnesota Environmental Partnership. It's a partnership of over 100 environmental organizations located throughout the state as well. I want to build a little bit on what Representative Hornstein said in the beginning and Ms. Hamilton as well about why we're doing this bill and really why it matters for issues, certainly about greenhouse gas emissions, but for a whole host of issues as well. You know, when I think about this bill, I know it's about the growth that's coming to Minnesota. Minnesota is projected to add about 1.3 million new people by 2030. This bill is really about how we can incorporate that growth in a way that sustains our environment, increases our competitiveness, and adds value to our communities. Because what we don't want to do is add that amount of people based on last century's model of cheap energy. So as you know, that era is gone. But less well known is how the demographics of the state are changing as well. Like the rest of the country, the senior population is the fastest growing segment of the population. Demographers often refer to this as the silver tsunami. By 2020, there will be more people over 65 than in K-12 education. Additionally, families are having fewer children, younger people are staying single longer, and a growing number of households are choosing not to have children at all. To put this in some perspective, in 1960, just about 50% of households were two parents with children, and now that is only 23% of households. I mention all this because this change in demographics is clearly shifting consumer preferences towards communities where people have greater choices in where they live and how they move around. The crux of the issue is that we've built communities over the last half century that have given us little choice. we have largely required, usually driving longer and longer distances, for just about every trip, getting a gallon of milk, dropping the kids off at school, even going to the neighborhood park. In fact, while we often think of our commute to work when we think about traffic and congestion, that's only 15% of the trips we take every day. 85% of the time, we pick up the car keys. It's to do the errands, those kind of mundane day-to-day errands I mentioned before. Going, dropping out the kids at school, going to the grocery store, going to the park. And that's a function of our land use patterns over time, that it spreads things out further and further over time. The good news for us is that changes in land use do not require technological breakthroughs or massive infrastructure investments, and they can result in big cost savings. A recent national study by the Urban Land Institute to the Real Estate Industry Research Institution suggests that modest changes in land use, such as mixing uses, pedestrian-friendly designs, and more compact development, could reduce driving by 20 to 40%. Doesn't mean stopping driving. We're all going to need our cars for a long time, but it means you don't have to drive everywhere to do everything, and you have choices when you make those decisions. So some other issues, I think we heard a lot about the global warming issue. I want to mention a couple other benefits we get from the implementation of this bill. First, the public infrastructure cost savings. More compact communities clearly cost the public sector far less in the long term than more spread out communities for more efficient use of infrastructure. According to a Metropolitan Council study, a more compact development form, which would give people the opportunity to walk more, rely more on transit, and generally drive shorter distances, could save $3 billion in infrastructure costs over 20 years. Secondly, personal transportation costs. The Bureau of Labor Statistics refers to as household transportation costs. This is intuitive, but it bears repeating when we think of our current economic condition. Transportation has been steadily grabbing a larger share of household budgets. It is now the second largest expense behind only a mortgage. This burden is far greater, of course, in communities with little transportation choice and will only be exacerbated by rising fuel prices. This is why most people that deal in workforce housing recognize that access to transportation as integral to any meaningful definition of affordability. I think Representative Hornstein talked about energy security. I won't belabor that any further. Finally, other environmental benefits. Of course, this has been a discussion that's been talked about a long time before we started talking about global warming. I was lucky enough to be on the Statewide Conservation Planning Commission. This was the LCCMR-funded study doing a big look, statewide conservation plan for the next 50 years in Minnesota. What are the drivers of environmental damage, and what can we do about it? And again, that study, this is in addition to the MCAG study, came out very clearly that we're going to have to reduce our per capita VMT over time, vehicle miles traveled over time, by providing people with more choices, and also starting to support more incentive-based conservation design principles, sort of community-based planning principles for communities to use. So this was the statewide conservation plan, came out supporting many of our programs. The MCAG study as well. If you all heard the informational hearing last week, I believe it was, the Center for Transportation Studies, coming up with the same solutions over and over again. So we really have studied this issue quite a lot, and we keep on coming up with the same solutions over and over and over again. I just end that at the beginning of my testimony, I mentioned the projected growth in Minnesota's population. Another kind of interesting tidbit to leave you with. 50% of the development on the ground by 2050 will be built between now and then. And this has been cited several times in different bodies of research. What this does provides an enormous opportunity for us to rethink the public and private costs of our transportation investments and land use policies. What this bill does is set the policy framework moving forward that is informed by the emerging new realities of rising and erratic energy prices, climate change, continued demographics, and shifting consumer preferences. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Bailey. And any questions for Mr. Bailey? Okay, seeing none, thank you for your testimony today. We do have two others. Mr. Craig Johnson from the League of Minnesota Cities. Welcome, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Craig Johnson. I'm representing the League of Minnesota Cities. And I am here to mention a couple of issues that we're working on with the author on this legislation. And have been very happy to do so. It's been a very cooperative process. We do have a ways to go before we're done with the bill, I think, but just make a couple of comments that are appropriate to some of the environmental policies in here tonight, if it's okay with the committee. Minnesota cities have been spending a tremendous amount of time, especially recently, dealing with energy issues, dealing with growth issues, development issues, and trying to integrate all of these issues together. Through their planning, through their decision making, we've been seeing an awful lot of interest in this, and cities essentially trying to step into a bigger leadership role. That said, I have some concerns that some of the things being done in here are going to put us in a situation where we're not able to make those flexible decisions quite as easily, and it may even have some unintended consequences that I would hope we could avoid. I guess I will focus my comments on Section 4 of the DEA, which is the environmental review provisions that have been put in here. And to be fair, we've been working hard on this with some of the environmental supporters of this. They're trying very hard to address local government concerns. I think this has come a long way. And we've only had a couple of hours to look at this. So some of these are more concerns that we have to still discuss with them as we go. But as we go through this section, very much appreciate the amendment made by the committee in Section B that does change it to language closer to what we've been discussing with the supporters of this section. In Section D, there's a couple of issues that I think stand out here. The requirement is that a guidance document will be prepared by the Environmental Quality Board, but it shall consider the Pollution Control Agency's carbon footprint requirements. And the carbon footprint requirements used by the Pollution Control Agency right now are only used in cases where a project would emit 100 tons or more per year of airborne toxic emissions. And to equate the list of types of projects that you find in G sub 2, which includes residential development, wastewater systems, golf courses, and recreational trails, having to do that level of environmental review on air emissions seems like an awful lot of work for something that does not come anywhere near 100 tons a year of a toxic air emission. The further part that has some concern to it is in lines 3.25 and 3.26. It says that the guidance document must include examples of alternatives and mitigation measures. Including examples is fine, but if it is an official guidance document from the agency responsible for setting the protocols for doing environmental reviews, that can in turn end up requiring the same types of alternatives and mitigation be included in the environmental reviews, or it's not considered an adequate review. I know that's not the intent here, at least I don't believe it is, so I think that's just a wording issue we need to work on. In Section E, the phrase at the end of line 3.28 says that the board will prepare an amended environmental assessment worksheet consistent with this subdivision, and then includes the phrase to be used where applicable. If the intent is that this only applies to the types of projects in this subdivision, it already says that. I don't think we need it. What I'm concerned with is that the phrase to be used where applicable means that there could be other things added on that are not part of this subdivision, and that would be a concern for not knowing what was coming in that guidance document. Again, I think that's a wording issue we can work out. Then in Section F, it says that the final report will come back to the legislature on specific recommendations. The report will include an analysis of mitigations and alternatives for all projects that undergo environmental review. I just want to make sure members are very clear that that is a fairly significant departure from what is currently listed as what is done under environmental assessment. Neither alternative analysis or mitigation requirements are currently done as part of the listed requirements of an EAW. Alternative analysis and mitigation for those alternatives, in place of those alternatives, is done as a cumulative study, so in an AUAR, an alternative urban area review, or with an environmental impact statement. Then finally, I just wanted to raise a couple of concerns in subpart 2 with the list of types of projects included as transportation-related development projects. In particular, for cities, wastewater systems become a very important one on this. And even more urgently, this is not a long-term issue, but short-term issue, as we look at implementing the federal stimulus requirements and how quickly those projects need to be up and running, these environmental review requirements will be in place before some of those facilities are permitted and built. And this would require us to include in their analysis greenhouse gas emissions for the various purposes stated in here. It could cause delays we don't want or need at this time on these projects. And I don't know what we would do for analysis on mitigation in those cases. So, Mr. Chair and members, other than that, most of the work we are doing on this is in the sections at the end of the bill related to the comprehensive plan requirements and what will be included. I don't want to go into details on those here. We will be working on those for the local government committee. But it does include a lot of changes to how local governments, in particularly in the metropolitan area, would have to regulate the types of development that occur. Because comp plans are a planning tool, but they are required to be reflected in all your local controls after that. So your land use planning, your zoning, your other planning and ordinance tools in your community. And we will continue to work with the author and the supporters of the bill on addressing our concerns in that area. I'd be happy to answer any questions I can.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Representative Junkie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As long as we're on this section, to the author or to the cities, I don't care who. I was looking at lines 4.5 through 9 also, and you know, this section relates to Representative Hornstein transportation-related development projects. So can you explain to me why wastewater systems are related to transportation or even solid waste facilities? And then my next question will be on the land use conversion. But if you can start with the wastewater and the solid waste, why they are transportation related?
I'll take a crack at that, but I can also talk. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll take a crack at that and also maybe have Mr. Bailey or one of the others comment. But you know, solid waste facilities relate very directly to some of the demographic issues that we had referenced earlier. You know, I think, you know, one can make a case, Representative Junkie, that's not directly transportation related, and I think we may want to take a look at that. But I think wastewater projects and sewer interceptors are very much related to, you know, how communities, directly how communities are planned, how they grow. It's kind of similar to a highway in that you can't have development without it. And so we may need to sort of have a different category for that rather than transportation related. But
right.
I think maybe more than solid waste, I think that relates much more directly to the bill. But solid waste is important because, again, if we're having 1.3 million more folks coming to the state, we're going to need to have some changes in those facilities, where they're sited, but I can see that would be a different.
Mr. Chair, I'm not arguing. Again, I'm not arguing at this point yet. The inclusion of those things in this bill, but in this section, I'm questioning it.
Mr. Chair, I think those are reasonable points, and we may want to look at that.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hornstein, I guess I'd ask the same thing under land use conversion. Do we have a definition for that in statute somewhere, or in your mind, what does that mean? And again, you wrote two small examples into statute now, including golf courses and recreational trails. Again, recreation trails, again, I'm getting that, I guess, for transportation, but golf courses? I mean, there are golf carts on golf courses. I mean, I'm trying to stretch into this a little bit. And why did you list just those two? What would be another host of examples of use conversion projects, and or should you have that defined somewhere in statute rather than listing a couple examples?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think on that one I'm going to have to call Dial Lawyers, and I have one here, Mr. Urkel.
Mr. Urkel, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative, there's been a lot of discussion going back and forth with the local government interests.
Mr. Urkel, if you could identify yourself for the day, please.
I apologize. My name is Jim Urkel. I'm with the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, and I direct MCEA's Land Use and Transportation Program. I also served on the Transportation and Land Use Technical Working Group for the Governor's Climate Change Advisory Group with Mr. Johnson. He wasn't there. There were lots of other people that were. Anyway, on the point about the transportation-related project, because we've been going back and forth a lot today, the descriptor really should be land use and transportation-related projects. That inadvertently dropped off. And so if that is really what we're after, then a lot of the kinds of projects that Representative Junkie mentioned play out in more appropriately in the bill. In terms of the question of land use conversion and golf courses, that actually is set out in the EQB rules in part 4410. And there are mandatory EAW requirements that are set out for those kinds of conversions. There are definitions that are contained in that as well.
Again, Mr. Chair, are those the only two things that come under land use conversions? Why did you specifically pull those two things out to put in statute? If this section now is about land use too, which we haven't amended it yet, but I'll take your word for it that that's something maybe Representative Hornstein will put in, but why did you list, let's just take golf courses, why did you list golf courses specifically? Are there not other things in land use conversion that requires EAWs or EISs why did we pull that out and put it in? I'm just trying to understand, I don't have anything against golf courses one way or the other. It's odd to see examples thrown in there without the whole list.
Mr. Urkel.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the idea was to take the categories that are set out in EQB's rules that were most directly related to land use and transportation. That's what we were trying to include. And as to land use conversion and golf courses, it does talk about golf courses, residential development where the lot size is less than 5 acres. It goes on to that. There's another section, projects resulting in the conversion of 640 or more acres of forest or naturally vegetated land to a different open space land use. And so in the Minnesota rule, part 4410.4300, subpart 36, those are laid out.
So, okay, yeah. So then the only one that's missing then would be the 640 acres. You didn't include that. I'm just trying to follow now. Why didn't you include that then?
Well, Mr. Chair, it was our intention in including the definition of that grouping of land use conversion, including golf courses, that we would pull up everything that's in that subpart.
Well, then let me ask again, then I'll get even more specific. Again, 640 acres of forest or vegetation land use conversion, is that in any way, shape, or form construed to mean agriculture? Clearly, we can convert 640 acres of CRP, Representative Wagenius, as an example, if it comes out of the program, can be converted back into agriculture. That's a conversion of the land. It's over 640 acres. Would that be included in here?
Mr. Chair, I'm reading through the guide that EQB puts out for environmental review rules. Mr. Wells may be able to help me here, but in the section dealing with land use conversion, including golf courses, there is a definition of open space land use, which says, is a function particularly oriented to an area's outdoor character, including agriculture, campgrounds, park and recreation areas. And so it would be a conversion of that to a different open space. I think it's actually trying to protect ag land from being converted to something else, including golf courses, residential development, commercial and industrial. So it's really trying, I think it's more of an ag preservation function than the other way around.
Well, I guess I'd just like confirmation on that. I appreciate your information, but instead of guessing, we need to know for sure. Not include any ag-to-ag type uses where we're, you know, going from corn to soybeans is a different land use, you know, and I just want to know, make sure that it's not including agriculture land under tillage or not under tillage in any way, shape, or form if it continues in agriculture land.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And kind of following on Representative Junkie, I'd like to ask the opposite question, because in some of the first-tier suburbs where I represent, you see golf courses being converted back into housing or development. And they're closer to where people work. We see golf courses put up for sale or redesigned or remodeled. So how would what you're proposing affect that land conversion?
Is that what you'd be looking for?
Mr.
Chair, the category in terms of golf courses, it would be mandatory to go through an environmental assessment worksheet if you have a golf course or other projects resulting in permanent conversion of 80 or more acres of agricultural, native prairie, forest, or naturally vegetated land. And converting it into another use. So I served for 7 years on the Woodbury Planning Commission. We had a three-part golf course that was converted into residential development. I don't believe it tripped this mandatory threshold, but you could have one that would. I mean, because it was a par three, it probably wasn't large enough. But if you had, you know, there are examples around the Twin Cities metro region of golf course, you know, full, you know, 18-hole golf courses that are being considered for redevelopment, this would probably trip the mandatory threshold.
Okay. Well, Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Urkel, or actually, this would be for the author. I got a couple questions. Page 3, on line point 3.5, it says life cycle housing opportunities. Do we need a definition for that? I don't know what life cycle housing opportunities are. And maybe the same for job-rich jurisdictions. I can get a sense of what that might mean, but it could be a variety of definitions that people may come up with.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Drazkowski. I think the first one I may be able to help you with. The second one, I might need some help from one of the advocates here. But generally, life cycle housing, the term is used to deal with, again, people through all phases of life, you know, apartments, the starter homes, senior housing. So it kind of runs the gamut, is my understanding.
Yeah. And Mr. Bailey?
Mr. Chair, Reverend Drazkowski, I think that's the case. I think you're asking specifically, is there an official definition out there and why isn't it included? And I don't believe there is an official definition of it, but we could, you know, work on one if that's preferable. To your second question, which is about what are job-rich jurisdictions, to use the language and a further explanation, I don't think there's a official definition of that either. Where that's coming from is the idea that especially the challenge we have with traffic congestion often is that jurisdictions really want jobs, but they don't want the housing to go along with the jobs. And then you have jurisdictions like very, very rich in jobs and in employment, but you know, push away all the housing development, and then you have kind of traffic issues, and you also have the challenge of people that work in those jobs don't have a convenient place to live near where they work. So that's where the idea is coming from, but to your question about the in kind of legal definition, I don't know if one actually exists, but you'd be happy to kind of work on one if you think this makes the bill better.
Okay. And Representative Sterner.
Just from my experience, job-rich jurisdictions, in my opinion, is that when you have more jobs in the area than you have housing to go with it, similar to what you have said, and then life cycle, I think, with birth to grave is what we've had, you know, in my experience with livable communities and city government.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Sterner. Any other questions for Representative Drazkowski?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know who this question might be for, but the section on the Environmental Quality Board, I understand the governor is looking at eliminating the Environmental Quality Board. What does that mean for the future of this bill?
I suppose that depends on what happens with the governor's proposal. But, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I'll have Mr. Bailey respond to that.
Mr. Bailey?
I would repeat what the chair says. I mean, the representative's correct. It is zeroed out in the governor's budget, and that'll be figured out through the legislative process this session. Yeah. I don't have an answer on, you know, where it would go if that succeeded, if that's what you're asking.
Okay. Thank you. And we do have one other testifier, Ms. Emily Grillett, or Garlett. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Annalie Garlick, and I work with the Association of Minnesota Counties. I will be brief in my testimony. I want to, I'm actually going to reflect and concur with a lot of what Mr. Johnson from the League of Cities brought up as concerns in terms of the environmental review portion of this bill. Counties have been involved in discussions with the author of this bill and with other groups that are interested in this language as well. And we initially expressed concerns on the environmental assessment worksheet and review language that was in the first version of this bill. So we're appreciative to see that new ideas have been brought forward. However, we still are not quite comfortable with the language as it's written here. It raises a lot of questions, and this is the first time that I'm seeing this particular language, so I do need to bring it back to talk with the zoning administrators around the state that this language will impact to determine the amount of time this will, environmental assessment worksheets are done, as you just heard, by the regulating government units, which oftentimes are the local units of government. And I need to talk with the county staff to determine the amount of staff time and resources they think that this would contribute to the time that it takes them to do the environmental assessment worksheet. Right now, the environmental assessment worksheet is a worksheet, and it's meant to be a quick review of this, of various projects that come before the local units of government. And Mr. Johnson brought up the language on line 3.35, mitigation and alternatives. The suggestion by the local unit of government to do mitigation and alternatives as part of the project. EAWs currently do not include the suggestion of different mitigation and alternative methods for projects. So that would be in addition to what's already going into the environmental assessment worksheet. And then another question that I had, I'm appreciative to see that there would be guidance that would be created as part of determining what the carbon footprint in the development would be. However, in Part D, it refers to lines 3.29 through 3.21, it talks about an analysis of project energy use in order to characterize and measure direct and indirect greenhouse gas emissions. And I'm just curious as to how that would fit into the environmental assessment worksheet. It appears to be an additional duty for the local units of government to look at. And if we don't have the resources available to us to help us analyze that, that would be an additional burden on local government that we're looking at. So I'm pleased to see this right now. I will be working with the author on this and talking with the other practitioners in local government about this. And then I too, you had brought up some of the language in subpart 2 about what a transportation-related development project is, and I also had some questions about why certain things fell under transportation-related development, such as solid waste facilities, the wastewater treatment facilities, and the land use conversions. So I would be happy to continue talking about those, but those are the concerns that I have right now after my first review of it. And in addition, I also want to express the same concerns about the comp planning piece in Section 12. We'll continue to work on that with the bill author and the other interested groups to try to refine and keep discussing that language, because counties do have some concerns about that as well.
Okay. And Representative Hornstein.
Mr. Chair, if I can respond briefly.
Sure.
I don't think there's anything unreasonable that the counties or cities have stated here that I have huge disagreement with. You know, I'm pretty familiar with environmental reviews, so the point they're making about 3.35 is well taken. And so, you know, I'll recommit here, you know, on the record to work through some of these issues. I didn't find anything really unreasonable in these conversations or anything that would, I think, significantly alter some of our goals, at least in the environmental review section. You know, the comp planning, and you know, we're going to have to really work through that, but nothing really unreasonable and that I would have major disagreement with in terms of the testimony heard on the environmental review section.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Hornstein. Any questions for Ms. Garlitz or Representative Hornstein? Yes, Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Hornstein. Just a couple of questions along the lines of the question that was raised earlier by the League of Cities testifier regarding projects to be used with the federal stimulus money. And so would projects that have already been designed, perhaps highway projects and that, environmental impact statements have long been completed, would they have to go back and redo those assessments in a short period of time if they're on that stimulus project list?
Representative Hornstein.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, that might be the one thing I may wish to take issue with in terms of Mr. Johnson. I think these guidelines are in process. I don't think many people even know right now what the feds have in mind in terms of the exact criteria that will be used. So to simply say, well, you know, in order to move forward with a stimulus project, we're going to have to modify environmental review, I think is certainly premature and speculative. So, you know, this is still a work in progress, the stimulus package. And obviously we would want to, you know, make sure that the good projects are expedited and get done. But I think it would be a little premature to speculate on whether this will interfere with the federal stimulus money. It's worth, I mean, certainly a consideration, and, you know, as these guidelines become available out of Washington, we'll monitor them and insert them in the bill as appropriate.
Representative Loon.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the manner in which you're, you know, approaching this and working with the cities and counties and others on this, but I guess, you know, just to reiterate my concern, I know I'm particularly on some of the transportation projects, the goal is to try to move forward with some quote-unquote shovel-ready things very quickly, and a lot of these projects are on the books with EIS statements being done for a long time. So I just want to make sure we're not holding up that process. Another thing that I'm sure the cities and counties will talk to you about, but I did talk to my local city, and they have just completed their comprehensive plan and submitted it to Met Council. And it's on their desk for review now. And the one thing that they raised was maybe you could talk about some flexibility in perhaps the timelines for some of these, because I knew that they do invest hours and hundreds of thousands of dollars in some cases in preparing these plans and asking them to go back and redo them all. And it's my understanding they're generally 10-year plans. Could be a real economic concern for a number of cities, especially right now.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Johnson, did you have...
Mr. Chair, to the question that was asked, I don't believe projects would have to go back and redo environmental review if they've already been approved. We will have a lot of projects other than in transportation, though, that will be proposed and do their environmental review during the course of the next 18 months, in particular in water infrastructure projects. Both drinking water and stormwater projects will have to go through the process very quickly. We don't even have enough projects to do use all the funding we have right now on the current waiting list in some of those areas. So there is going to be a rush to get these projects ready and on the ground as quickly as possible. And that was the statement I was making, is referring to those that, in particular, in the water infrastructure funding, both in the drinking water and in the clean water revolving funds, 20% of those funds are supposed to be used for green infrastructure projects. We don't have a category of those in our current state priority system. We're going to have to create that, which means there's going to be projects that have to get approved fairly quickly.
Representative Hornstein.
Mr. Chair, I just conclude this particular topic. I've been monitoring pretty closely the transportation stimulus piece and working with MnDOT on that. And, you know, we've just had no indication that anyone would have to do extra environmental review as a result of the stimulus package. But again, you know, I'm not as familiar with water as Mr. Johnson, but we'll take a look at that. But I think it would be highly unlikely that additional environmental review would be required as a result of the stimulus project.
Okay.
And in process.
Okay. And in terms of the environmental assessment worksheets and reviews that are necessary here, just curious about how long they normally take. Maybe I know there was testimony given earlier about the process in general, but as far as the cost generally, it's not meant to be a long process like EIS is. I'm just wondering how much more this would add. It seems to me that it's adding on to an already existing process, and that it's I'm just wondering how onerous it would be. And I know that's the question, I guess, being asked, is how much is this going to require of the local units? Is it going to be onerous, or is there anybody that could testify to that directly? From the ETD. Mr. Wells.
Mr. Chairman, John Wells again. I can give you my judgment, and that is that the ETB would, first of all, we would want to look to a threshold of effect. It's not, you know, even though the bill would say we deal with every land use and transportation category, there has to be some thought about a threshold within that category on climate change gas emissions. So if there's no significant emissions for a project, even if you need to do an EAW, it doesn't require any more work. And that's how we would write those guidelines. Okay. So for those things that did require more work or some assessment, we are planning on looking to the PCA and their work, as well as the University of Minnesota, to get some simple carbon calculators. We're not going to make this thing change the whole nature of the EAW process.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Wells can correct me if I'm off on this, but it's my understanding that an EAW takes anywhere from 6 to 9 months, and EIS can take up to a year and a half. Sometimes longer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hornstein, of course, it depends on how rigorous people feel they need to do to avoid being taken to court, which is what tends to make this thing take a lot longer than it should, and be people in some situations decide to do a Cadillac EAW to avoid doing an EIS. That was never really the intent. It has tended to gravitate that way, just because we're a litigious society. EAWs don't even need to take 6 to 9 months either. I mean, it ranges all over the place as far as that goes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Wells. And we do have one more bill on the agenda, so... Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question would be to Mr. Johnson and maybe Ms. Garlitz. This bill, as you look at it, it's plumb full of mandates. It's an alternative title for it could be an omnibus mandate bill to local units of government. Have you talked with your local cities and counties? I'm very surprised that there's not uproar among your constituencies about this. We don't even know what this means in terms of number of FTEs for the average community. And what it's going to be in terms of cost for those communities, and how they're going to pay for it in the current budget environment. This has got to be a very difficult bill for your constituencies where we're at right now, and I'm just surprised we're not hearing more of those realities.
Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, Representative, had you heard testimony at the first hearing on the Senate side on this, you might have heard it said more loudly and strongly, because we had not worked with anyone yet on addressing some of those concerns. The environmental review section that we're talking about tonight is one that our planners are concerned about, how much time and effort it's going to take them. We have cities that are currently not able to get decisions done within the 60 days rule 15, statute 15.99 require them to do it in. And to add additional requirements, this does not affect the 60 days because environmental review is separate from that, but it adds to the workload of the people to process those other permits in the same city. In a large city with lots of staff, it can still maybe be workable, but in a smaller city, there may only be one or two people that process everything. So, and we have plenty of those smaller size, less staffed cities within the metropolitan area here as well. On the comp planning piece, we are actually doing a lot of work on that with the author to remove additional workload for local governments in that. The initial bill as drafted, and I believe that the lead all still has it this way, has language that it requires amendments to comp plans outside of the normal comprehensive planning process. We really don't want to do that. Our cities in the metro area all have their revised comp plans sitting at the Met Council waiting for final approval right now. They haven't even been approved in most cases, and we don't want to have to start revising them while we still have the last one sitting on the shelf waiting for approval. So we're working on that with the author, but it really, our concern has been the staff and budget concerns over this.
Representative Horne,
just quickly, thank you. I think
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gretzkowski, you raise a very good question. I think it is, you know, the crux of the matter here. And our intention is to strike a balance between not requiring things that are onerous, because it simply won't work. I mean, it just is, it's not practical, politically or otherwise. But on the other hand, we do need to move on this, and we do need to work in partnership with cities, counties, other levels of government, because we have an urgent issue. We've heard about 1.3 million people moving into the state. We've heard about, I think, very clearly, this committee is more familiar than others in the legislature about the impact of global warming and oil dependency, and also the graying of our state. How are we going to make communities, none of us are getting any younger, you all have hair, I don't, but we really have to make some changes in how we do planning. So we can't just simply stand still and tread water. So some of these communities are going to have to change how they do this. But we want to do it in a way that's reasonable and that we can actually get the work done. And that'll be, if there's no other questions, my final statement.
Okay. There is another question here. Representative Johnson.
My question is a statement. Again, this isn't a finance committee. I would suggest you probably, or to be here maybe, don't have a fiscal note done. But in our fiscal notes, there is local government costs reflected there. So we will see that eventually, what a cost might be to any one of our cities. That will be in our fiscal notes, and certainly I would concur with folks who understand. I think most people on this table understand that if we're cutting local government aid or we're doing other things, this year might not be the year to, it might be next year, or it might be, or you might take those money cost sections out to local governments this year to move on what you can. But certainly that's something that I suspect when it gets into finance will be tracked very closely, both in the division where it's at and coming out in the larger finance committee, where I'll have an opportunity to see that fiscal note, so, as well as everyone else. So this is a policy committee, and but I think we all have the concerns about the cost, and we will see that fiscal note, though.
Okay. Thank you. And any further questions? I want to thank Representative Hornstein. Thank you for picking up the ball on this. This is, I think it is a very important issue, and that while there's concern about the costs, as you'd said, I mean, we need to strike the right balance, and there is that growing population issue that we need to deal with in this state. And one thing that's interesting is that the trend seems to be moving in the direction towards more sustainable land use. So hopefully we can continue to guide it in that direction. And,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
And appreciate your work on this. With that, I will renew the motion that House File 898, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on State Government and Local Government Operations. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Thank you very much.
That's Representative Dill. And do I have to?
Mm-hmm.
We don't have to vote on. Yeah, we do have to vote on this. I'll vote in favor of the signify by saying aye. And then. Okay. We do that first. And then. Okay. And Representative Dill, I guess since this is a division report bill, we do have to move the adoption of the report. So would you like to move the adoption?
I'll move the adoption, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Dill moves the adoption of the Game, Fish, and Forestry Division report for House File 128. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails, and the division report is adopted. That is now before us. And Representative Dill, would you like to move the bill?
Yes, and I don't know the appropriate is the next where the next stopping place is.
Yeah, it would be the Committee on Public Safety.
All right, I'd like to move House 128 and recommend it pass and sent to Public Safety.
Okay, Representative Dell moves that House File 128, the first committee engrossment, be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Public Safety. And Representative Dell to the bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and may I have co-author Representative Cornish, also a member of this committee, and I'm happy to be here to present this bill to you. But again, it did pass the Game of Fish Committee on a voice vote, and this is about removing firearms and bow case requirements that are presently in place. And so the first picture that I have that's on the screen, members, is these are ethical and safe hunters that are currently acting illegal, and I'd like to mention to you that most of them have their smiles on their face, so they're quite happy and not really realizing that they're illegally operating. And you notice the Labrador down there is very happy that they have are out of field. The next picture is more of the same. PAC members of thousands upon thousands of people break the current laws without even knowing that really having a full knowledge that they're actually doing it, because even though you're on private land, you cannot have an uncased firearm on or in a motor vehicle, even on your private land. And these people are being transported around different fields in pursuit. I think most of these pictures are pheasant hunting. I also want to show you a picture that was in the Minneapolis Star Tribune in 2006, taken by Dennis Anderson. These are some young people, all of them under the age of 18, that are participating in a youth trap shooting event. And that picture is also illegal operation with a firearm, because their firearms are on an ATV and they are uncased. But you notice they're really smiling. So what this bill does is it regulates the actions of ethical law-abiding hunters and represents the vast majority of the state sportsmen and women that are afield. And it allows hunters to have uncased and unloaded, meaning nothing in the chamber and nothing in the magazine, and it does not include handguns. So unless you have a concealed carry permit, you will have to continue to keep a handgun as the current law states. It also involves unarmed bows, and what unarmed bows means is you have to have it unstrung and no bolt or arrow in a position to fire, much like the unloaded portion of the long guns that we're referring to. Now, exemptions where casing would still be required are local units of government that have enacted a discharge ban. So, local units of government, we queried the League of Minnesota Cities, and they told us they had a listing of about 90 cities presently having a discharge ordinance. School property, that does not change. Game refuges, that's current law. While shining, that's current law. And also while using night vision equipment, current law. And each current law is specified here on the PowerPoint. And why is it needed? We'll start with duck hunting. Duck hunting, let me just say without using the PowerPoint, if you are in a boat or you're on a ground blind, and you shoot a duck and it's out on the water, and it requires by law that you immediately, as soon as possible, dispatch the duck or goose, you would have to very likely get in a boat. You'd have to unload your gun, put it in a case, then start the motor and proceed out to where the duck is, then stop the motor, come to a halt, unload your gun, case the gun, shoot the duck, put the gun back and unload the gun if you put more than one shell in it, put it back in the case, then go after the duck. And if you didn't kill the duck and now you had to get within reach of it again, which is about 40 yards or less, you just have to keep repeating that over and over and over again until you got the duck retrieved. And it's even more difficult when a firearm is wet, because generally around the water, at least you get your gun wet. And it also proposes the damage to the gun by putting it in a gun case. And what happens is you put it in the gun case wet, now your case is wet. It's not like you could wipe the gun off and then put it back in, because now your case is wet. And the Minnesota Waterfowlers support this legislation. The same thing in the pictures that you saw. During a drive, a group of trucks may drop off hunters at one end of a plot, a cornfield maybe, or a CRP field, and then maybe a different group of trucks, or maybe one truck, like in the pictures we showed you, would pick them up, and unless they had their case in the vehicle, when they were picked up at the end of a cornfield, they would be illegal by being like the pictures I showed them. Also, even if you were on private land, and you were going to hunt the same field, because you know cornfields sometimes are quite wide, half a mile wide, half a mile long, and it takes 6 or 7 drives sometimes to completely cover a cornfield while pheasant hunting. This might happen 6 or 7 times during the course of event of hunting, and these people are just law-abiding people, and they're just doing what they think is right, and sure enough, they're not doing it right. Also, hunters that are deer hunting, that are making the same kind of a thing, a deer drive, or are in their cabin, and they go out to their deer shack, and now somebody stops by to pick them up for lunch, and their case is back in the deer shack. Again, illegal. And also, the Minnesota Deer Hunters support this legislation. I think they have in the neighborhood of 20 to 25,000 members. Maybe Mr. Kelleher, if he's here, he can tell us the exact number. And they support this legislation. Somewhere in the neighborhood of 95% of the deer hunters supported this legislation. At shooting ranges, I showed you the picture of the kids at shooting ranges on the golf cart ATV. This happened tens of thousands of times, because at the Minnesota State Trap Shoot, I made it a point to count the number of ATVs that had firearms on them uncased up in Alexandria last July, and there were over 100 within. I walked the entire half mile shooting line, and there were about 100 ATVs just behind the trap line, all with guns on them, all being operated illegally. As well, I was in a motorhome traveling to another state down in the Owatonna area, and I pulled out my gun to start replacing a couple of trigger springs, and the person driving the motorhome said, you know, I'd really prefer that you not do that, because we're operating illegally, and if we get stopped for some reason, we might, you know, be in jeopardy of being violated. Being a state representative, I certainly didn't want to be in violation of any laws at all. So I put it away. That's just common sense type of things that don't really add up here. Now, the opponents to this bill will say, and I'm going to let Ripken Cornish deal with the opponents, because, you know, he's a very highly experienced, and highly efficient conservation officer retired, and so I'm going to let him deal with with the opponent part then. Okay.
Members of the committee, Tony Cornish, one of your members, and I would just want to cover the what the opponents will say, the most commonly used arguments against this bill, and give you some comfortability. First of all, you've probably heard or read that portions or all of the DNR report that was given out on our unengaged gun proposal. I think the mistake that the DNR made with this report is that they compared Minnesota to North and South Dakota, which are loaded gun states. In North Dakota, you can have it loaded in the magazine. In South Dakota, you can have it loaded in the magazine and chamber. So the statistic you draw from that, naturally, they're going to have probably more accidents, because we're dealing with an unloaded gun. Even saying that the accident rates, if you examine them in that study, have more to do with carelessness outside the motor vehicle than they do with anything in the motor vehicle. It's swinging on game, and they're without looking what your backstop is, and another thing, shooting themselves in the foot outside of the truck in a hurry to shoot a coyote or something. And it didn't really have anything to do with our law, because our law here, our proposal, is for an uncased and unloaded firearm. No portion of our law supports a loaded firearm. Presently, a firearm cannot be loaded while it's in a motor vehicle or while on a motor vehicle. In Minnesota, you can't even have it on a motor vehicle. If you set it on a motor vehicle, you can be tagged for transporting an uncased firearm. And it just seems like this just a pretty ridiculous statute, that even though the vehicle is shut off and sitting there, you can still be tagged for that. Accidents are actually probably more likely to happen during the constant casing and uncasing than they are with having an uncased gun. And talking to the officials in North and South Dakota, the game officials, personally, on the phone with either one of them, none of them have said that they've had any more accidents, they think, caused by the uncased gun law. It's more of the carelessness outside the vehicle. In this slide about North and South Dakota conservation officers and the officer safety issue, That's another point that was raised by law enforcement. You'll hear that this is an officer safety issue. North and South Dakota chief conservation officers both said that they don't believe this is an officer safety issue because they're used to coming up on these vehicles with loaded guns in both states, and that hasn't been the problem. Their officers are more worried about when one officer walks out in the middle of a field and you've got 10 hunters standing around him or her with a loaded gun. The vehicle doesn't present the problem. So they don't believe that it's an officer safety issue, and neither one of them could remember a case where something has been reported as an officer safety issue caused by the uncased gun. Now, another thing that the opponents will say is city and counties will pass their own ordinance creating confusion or patchwork of regulations. This is prohibited by the preemption statute. If we pass a law to do with firearms, a city or county can't pass one that contradicts that. The state law would preempt the cities from doing that, and that is under 471.633. Hunters already know where they can legally discharge a firearm or bow, and so, and where to case or not. If we have our proposal come through, just like a hunter has to know what zone he or she can hunt in, or what permit area he or she can hunt in, or the laws about size limits on lakes for different walleyes, or using minnows that were in lakes you can and can't do. Hunters know that, and so they will know where they can carry a gun or a firearm in or out of the case. And if they don't know, they're going to have it in a case. Next slide is using a motor vehicle as a platform for hunting is not fair chase, and the bill will increase poaching. This is another statement that was referred to in the DNR report. Nothing in this proposal that we have here before you today supports any type of using the vehicle for a platform for hunting. North and South Dakota have a law that permits their hunters to shoot right from the motor vehicle at varmints, at coyotes and such. This isn't included in our law. It's not loaded and not shooting from the vehicle. Our law does not support anything about poaching or anything is illegal from the shooting from a car. The North and South Dakota wardens, the chief officials, both told me that they don't believe that the uncased gun leads to further violations. In other words, when they're driving down the road with a hunter, if somebody is predisposed to violate, whether they're going to trespass or shoot out the window or shoot illegally at some game, it's the determining factor is not whether the case is on the firearm or not. The determining factor is if they want to break the law. They don't believe that a class one, what they maybe they called out there or our misdemeanor mailing fine, is going to stop them. It's not the case that determines that. And they don't believe that it is increased illegal activities like poaching. The next slide here, will undo years of hunter's education, two-step process of loading or unloading and casing a firearm. These are two separate actions. We can still teach in hunter safety, which they do in North and South Dakota, that it's better to have the gun in a case. Or you can teach in the steps about, nothing will change about what we teach in our hunter ed safety classes, both in the juvenile and the adult classes that we have. You can still teach anything you want to. It'll just have the option of putting it in a case or not. The determining factor in there is you should have that gun or firearm unloaded before you put it in the vehicle. That's the thing you remember. Not before you put it in the case, but it's before you put it in the vehicle. The case is the option. The hunters will still do the most important thing, and that's unload the firearm. Now, here's one that came up recently that we really are having a hard time figuring out. And somebody from law enforcement said that an uncased gun in the car will lead to more break-ins. An example was if somebody shows up with a gun in the easy carry gun rack and got the Kelly in. Well, first of all, St. Paul would probably be an accepted city, so you wouldn't have to have it uncased anyway. And all the times that I lived for 6 years at the Kelly Inn, I've yet to ever see a gun in the car down there. And to say that it's going to cause more break-ins, once again, I talked to the chiefs of police of Minot, North Dakota, and Pierre, South Dakota, on the phone yesterday afternoon, and I asked them about this. And they couldn't figure out that thinking. They said, well, it's like leaving a laptop on your seat or money on the dash. If they're going to break in, they're going to break in. And whether a gun is in the case or not in your car, why is that determinative of whether you're going to break the window or not? It's either the gun's there or not. The case doesn't have anything to do with it. So whether we have the new law enacted and have the uncased gun, it isn't going to do a thing to induce people to break windows or commit more break-ins on cars. In the North South Dakota report, no alarming statistics. In fact, the South Dakota Chief of Police of Pierre, South Dakota, said looking back through the records, the way the guns are acquired there is robberies of sporting goods stores, hardware stores, and residential burglaries. He couldn't remember offhand any ones that were taken out of cars and used in a crime.
Well, again, on the final thought, this is about people who follow the laws. We make laws for people that follow them, and then we arrest those who don't follow them. And this allows hunters to do what they're already doing, many of them. Many of them do and many of them don't. And it allows for unloaded long guns, not handguns, and it allows for unarmed bows in a motor vehicle. And this bill doesn't stop people from putting their gun in a case. In fact, I'm going to tell you practically that everywhere I travel, I have my gun case until I get a field. And that's when I don't want the gun in a case, including when I have to ride on a motor vehicle and go to another field or another portion of the field or into the small town where we might eat lunch. This is about hunters. This isn't about people who are going to do things unethically and unlaw-abiding. And frankly, I'm all for arresting them and giving them the maximum possible penalty. And, you know, an unloaded firearm is a safe firearm. It will not increase accidents if it's unloaded. And the department has said that the case requirement is a part of the double check of whether the gun is unloaded or not. And my claim is that it actually, by changing the law, it gives it a second step to consider, because the first step has nothing to do with the case, as Representative Cornish said. It has everything to do with teaching the person that before the gun may even touch, meaning leaning against the vehicle, on the back tire or by the bumper, it must be unloaded, because that's an illegal act. And before you put it in a vehicle, it must be unloaded. And the fact that you put it in a case or don't put it in a case shouldn't have any bearing on whether you've unloaded the gun, because the law is about unloading the gun before it's in or on a vehicle. So, again, there's been quite a number of articles. My emails have been at least 10-1 in favor of this. And there's a thing about letters to the editor in your packet, and I just want to read the very best part of one of them. It says, "Thank God for Representative Dylan Cornish, people who will get things done." I just thought I'd read that for you out of this. It's in your packet. And so, Mr. Chairman, that's our testimony on the bill. We'd like to hear from others and also answer any questions that you might have.
Sure. Representative Cornish.
Yes. Well, Mr. Chair, just to add one thing. We didn't come here to beat up COs or conservation officers, but last year there was 330-some tickets written for uncased guns, which caused thousands of dollars or the fines for our citizens, and they're just doing their job. That's what they're paid to do. But the problem is North and South Dakota have been doing this for years with no problem, and it doesn't make sense that we're fining our hunters and sportsmen and women over here for something that is perfectly legal in the two neighboring states without having any problem.
And Representative Junkie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just one quick question, one comment, though. Also, two lines is legal in all our neighboring states, too, so that's another one that makes no sense. So anyway, that's something else. Uncased, unloaded, how many other states have that?
I believe the right now is 14.
But not Iowa and Wisconsin?
No.
Chair.
Yes, Representative Dale.
And, you know, I have some familiarity with Nebraska, and they can be loaded, unloaded, uncased. Very common to see them in the back window. And, you know, they have metropolitan cities as well, Lincoln and Omaha. And, you know, it's not like there's, now granted, the population of Nebraska as a whole, there's more pheasants in Nebraska than there are people. But if you go to Omaha or Lincoln, they have just as many gangs per capita and just as much, you know, dishonest activity. If you go to Omaha, it looks just like Minneapolis. So I mean, the feel of it.
Oh, yeah.
It actually is better than that. They look West better Lake. Than that because West their Lake. River that runs through it isn't polluted.
Representative Ordinius.
I gave it. That was pretty good.
That was great timing. I'm looking online, 4.9. And it says the firearm is unloaded in the closed trunk of a motor vehicle. And I don't understand why in this case you wouldn't substitute the word locked for closed.
Right now, I think this is just putting this, Mr. Chair, members, this is just putting this in a different section here. Currently, if you have the firearm unloaded in the closed trunk of a motor vehicle, you're legal. And, or if you have it cased, the way it describes it there.
No, I think I'm reading, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dell.
I think I'm reading into this, Representative Genius, that you think that should say. And I think we're just putting this in a different section. That's the current law. But you're suggesting that it be a locked trunk rather than just a trunk.
Well, yeah, you're changing the case and uncased, so that does raise the question of why you wouldn't look to say locked, because one would assume you're saying that the car isn't going to be burglarized because the door is going to be locked, and even if a gun is in the car. But here you're just saying closed, when it seems to me that locked would be a better thing to do.
And you know, I have no objection to that. I can't remember, except when I was a college student, when I couldn't afford to fix the lock on my trunk, that all my trunks lock when I close them. So,
Representative Wagenius.
Well, some cars aren't that way. Neither. So, you know, I have to deliberately lock the trunk on my car from the inside of the car, but otherwise they're unlocked when I close them. Different mechanisms.
To that point, I don't know where that section came from. You're carrying something over, you know, putting a gun in a trunk is the substitute for the case. And being locked or not wasn't really the issue. And I know we talked about this earlier yesterday or something, a couple days ago, but now that I think it through, you know, you used to have to put in the trunk, and that's all this law is saying, because if you didn't have a case, that was a legal way to transport. And I'm not sure that locked would necessarily cover everything. And again, I'm trying to think back, you know, I have a Ford Explorer, and I'm not sure if I can put it in my trunk area, which is actually open to the front anyway also, as long as it's out of reach of me, the driver, if I didn't have a case. Cornish probably knows, because I'd probably get arrested if I did that or something. But, you know, trunk, the definition of trunk has changed over the years, too. It's not just the car trunk. There's SUVs and others. And that cargo area, I think you could probably transport it, but I'm not sure. I didn't know you couldn't shoot out windows until I got, you know, a little older either. I thought it's always if you stopped the car, you were okay. I grew up in rural Minnesota. We weren't, you know.
We won't ask how you discovered that was illegal. And Representative Cornish, I don't know if you have any answers for Representative Jones.
Mr. Chair, members, I think closed trunk, it just assumes that it's going to be a locked trunk. I don't know of any trunks that close that don't lock. The problem with putting lock trunk in, and then the definition, what does that mean? Do you have to put a hasp and a padlock besides it being closed? And I think there's probably an attorney general's opinion or something that I remember that even if you're in it's a closed trunk or the back of a pickup, if you have a topper on it with the door that closes, also classifies as current law, that you wouldn't have to have it in the case. So it's just a closed trunk. It's always been like that. I don't know if there's any need to change it.
Okay, and Representative Wagenius to this point?
Well, you said you didn't know of any trunk that didn't close, that doesn't lock. I actually have two cars that where you close the trunk, it doesn't lock. So there are cars out there that mm-hmm. you close the trunk. You can set it to lock. You can set it to not lock. So there are cars like that.
Okay. And Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Cornish, if I'm not mistaken, back end of a pickup as part of the ruling by the Attorney General, it constitutes a trunk for the purpose that of the way this is read for transporting of a gun. I think if you have a cover on the back of your pickup, could be one of the flat ones or a topper, that's a legal way, and I know that there is a CO here, a steel CO in the audience too. I believe that that is true, that the back end, and some of those do not have the ability to lock.
Mr. Chairman, that's what I had just said earlier, that you're right, that, that if you've got a topper on and the door closes, the door closes.
Sure. Okay, yes. Chief Conrad? Welcome, and if you could state your name for the state.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Chief Jim Conrad, Chief of Enforcement Division, or Chief of the Enforcement Division, Department of Natural Resources, and I can answer the question that the representative had regarding the back of a pickup. The test is that if it is fully enclosed and not accessible from the passenger part, in other words, the topper would be good as long as you didn't have one of those sliding glass windows that you could reach through to get into that section. And, of course, a tonneau cover that couldn't be accessed. And once again, if you had a toolbox in the back of the pickup truck that was closable, that would suffice as well under current law.
Okay. Thank you, Chief Conrad. Let's see, to this point, Representative Sterner? Yes, or, well, you can ask another question too, but I just...
All right, thank you.
Yeah.
I just had a few questions, but the first one, is there a fiscal note on this one, or will be?
Chair. Representative Dale.
No, sir.
No, okay. And then, Representative Cornish, just a couple of your perspectives, and I think I understand a few years ago you might have been opposed to this type of legislation, so I'm wondering what's changed on it, or why the thought changed, and then also from your experience at law enforcement, is there some concern on that possibly for police and that?
Representative Cornish.
Yes, Representative, Mr. Chair, I think what probably changed is when you go to rookie school as a game warden, you're trained this way, and you are trained to do your job, and you do it. I've written tickets for uncased guns, but after you retire and you had a chance to look at it, it's like when I first sent this letter out, an email, a mass email, the first five retired conservation officers I sent it to said, dump this law, we don't know why we did it in the first place. And I think that's the difference between to have an active officer and a retired one, and you have a chance to live through this and you finally get time to hunt, you see it. And then I think another thing was recently, in the last 3 years, I started for the first time ever taking vacations and going to South Dakota. And I realized that why aren't they excited about this, or why aren't they writing tickets out here? And they're shooting out of vehicle windows, and they've got... loaded guns, and there's no problem, and this one is unloaded, so it'd be even safer. And so I just figured, why not? I just come to the realization, why are we finding our hunters here when they're not in South Dakota and North Dakota with a more liberal law?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Dell.
Well, I'd like to add my two cents worth on that too, Representative Turner. I actually had this as an amendment 7 years ago, and when Representative Cornish had a real fly apart over it in committee, and I said, you know, maybe someday you're going to start thinking like a constituent instead of a conservation officer, and I think that's what he just said.
Representative Zaskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cornish and Dale, thank you for bringing this bill forward. I want to commend you. I think it's a great bill. I've, as a very active hunter myself, I've seen much of the same thing, very much an impediment for folks. I'm wondering if this might create actually more opportunity for the COs to focus on the real problems out there rather than some of these things that are not issues. And I would be interested in your comments. And I would just finish with a comment as a firearm safety instructor myself. The firearm safety part, really I think the gun cases in the class are really talked about as just from the need to comply with the law rather than at all concerning anything regarding safety, because that's covering the rest of the class. So interested in your comment on the ability of the conservation officer to provide attention to more meaningful work.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott. The interesting, you raised that question because I was talking to South Dakota Chief Warden, and he said that he was talking to an Iowa conservation officer. Iowa conservation officer is similar to our law. And he said the Iowa conservation officer has said after approaching hundreds of vehicles, he thinks it's more of an officer safety issue when you stop behind the vehicle and you see somebody wrestling around maybe with their case. He said he found out the conservation officers were running to the vehicle to catch them with the case down so they could give them a ticket, and you know, because they see them struggle with it. He said they were forgetting about officer safety as they ran up to that vehicle, about their positioning or, you know, checking the vehicle out to make sure it's safe. They're just on a beeline for the door to reach in and get the gun. So he thought that the uncased gun law like South Dakota has was actually safer for their officers. And I think, yeah, it would free them up. Of course, they're still going to look for loaded guns and shooting off the highway, things like that. But, you know, it's just a different perspective. I believe it's passed, and you might find another conservation officer would argue the other way.
Representative Junkie.
Well, I'm going back. I don't want your bill to get bogged down when it moves on. And the section Representative McDenius keeps referring to, and I'm looking at it now, is a school property section. So what you've done is you're rewriting something in the school property section. And I guess my question is, it would be that too. Why are you even adding this into the school property section? I mean, we've got schools already that certainly prohibit any weapons of any type on school property, cased, uncased, trunked, untrunked. So now you're putting something, and I'm trying to understand why you're doing it. You're putting something, you're allowing a gun to come onto school property. And of course, that's, I think, what Representative Guinness is concerned about, is this is a car sitting in a closed trunk on school property, which is why she wants it locked if it's sitting there on school property. But again, why are we even pulling this over into school property? Because I think when you get to the House floor and other places, if you're talking about guns on school property, you're going to elicit a lot of debate, I'm afraid. And I'm just wondering what you're up to there.
Representative Junkie, yeah, I can see where the point is raised, and spoke with Representative Bill, and we'd be interested in looking at that and revamping that or somehow figuring out the confusion that's caused.
I'm not sure what the purpose is pulling that into the school property rules, which are pretty strict already, but well, I don't have an answer, and I don't know if our research staff knows why it got pulled over there either. But.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Dill.
Well, I understand what you're saying, and really that wasn't my intent in the way that we authored the bill. That really wasn't what we were trying to get at. But realistically, if you live in a rural community and you're a kid, I can't tell you how many times that my son has gone duck hunting on Pelican Lake, and we live 40 miles out on an island. He has to take his gun to school. So what he does is he drives down to the IGA and gives the owner of the IGA the gun, and he takes it upstairs and puts it away, and then when he gets ready to go duck hunting after school, he goes down there and gets it rather than putting it in the trunk. Now, that's not the reason that that's in here, but, I mean, that's a practicality, and that's happening all over Minnesota where kids are having one eighth of a time trying to deal with this. And so, I mean, I'm not saying that that's what I want to do in this bill. I don't want to bog down the bill. We're willing to look at it and try and figure out how to navigate that section. But in practicality, I'm certain that almost all rural legislators have heard this exact same problem.
Maybe, I don't know, if you're interested in amending it so that it would say a locked closed trunk or a locked trunk.
Sure.
Yes, Representative
Johnson. Again, that's not the question. I mean, if it's going to be in there, it should say locked. But the question is whether we should put it in there at all. And I'm like Representative Dill. Again, I used to go duck hunting in the morning when I was a kid. We'd go to school. And we didn't lock our cars, and we had our guns with us. So for me to keep it safe, I brought it into school and put it in my locker, which was safer than keeping it in my car. I mean, it's just, it's the way we grew up. It's a different era. I get that, and I know there's still cases where kids try and fiddle with it. And, you know, our laws here do allow schools the right to give permission from superintendents and principals for them to bring guns for various reasons. And you know, if your principal or superintendent want to give, you know, it's pretty plain. I'm just afraid. If you're going to allow guns on school property, there's a lot of districts that ban them totally. And now you're going to elicit every superintendent to call their rep on the floor and say, how come Bill and Cornish are making it so our kids can bring guns on school property? You know,
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Bill.
That's a real good point. And again, I don't want it to get bogged down. I don't think I'm prepared at this moment to try and navigate fixing that language at this very moment.
Okay.
But it's not something that we're going to ignore. And we get we get Representative Wagenius's point as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, I was thinking maybe using the word locked might be a way to satisfy both sides, although I think you're probably right that as long as you're bringing guns on school property, it's going to be an issue, whether it's a locked trunk or
Now that you brought that up, we will probably work at even possibly eliminating that language out of the bill.
Okay. You'd like to wait, though, until...
You can tell how complicated of an issue this is, and to just be on the fly here, I don't like to pass bills out of my committee either that don't have it right, but I don't think we're prepared, and we do need to move on.
Okay.
And, I hear Representative Wagenius, she has come up and spoken to me about this issue, and now Representative Junkie brings up a really good issue, and unless someone has another suggestion.
Mr. Chair.
Sure.
Finally, does staff have any reason to understand why it was drafted this way?
Ms. Taylor?
Were you involved with the drafting, or was that just a reviser draft, or why is it in there?
Mr. Chair and members, all it is because we are changing 97B.045. If we didn't make this change, then it would go to the more permissive and allow uncased guns on school property. So this is just to retain the current restrictions. Obviously, some school districts have even more restrictive, but this was just to retain the current restrictions.
Okay, so no changes are actually made because of this language, the current law. No. Okay, well, that makes sense then.
Mr. Chair, I'm just trying to understand the law too, since the first time I've seen it. I don't serve on Public Safety or Education Committee, but where this may have come up. So for school districts that don't have the complete ban, this would be current law on school districts.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. Yeah, that would be correct.
That's a better explanation than I do.
Okay, great. Any other questions? Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to detract from the seriousness of the conversation here, but I'm very certain that I heard Representative Corney say that this is a more liberal law than the current law, and that's a big concern to me. We may have a real partisan issue going here, and everybody needs to consider it as we vote.
So, any other comments or questions? Okay, seeing none, Representative Dill.
I'd like to renew my motion. So I recommend that
someone wants to testify against
the
bill.
Go. Yeah, Mr. Meyer. I guess we do have one more testifier. Commissioner Meyer, welcome.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. For the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. And I was told today that the committee will do the opposite of what I say, so we do support the bill.
Oh, God. Now
with one change.
I got to rethink.
I appreciate the thought that Representative Dill and Cornish have been putting in to looking at some of the constraints that our hunters do have out in the field. And safety is our number one concern, and we do still consider the case firearm, unloaded case firearm, the most safe form of a stored weapon that is out there today. As most of their testimony talked about, trying to stop hunters from failing with the laws that are currently out there right now, I think the bill that is drafted still provides a hunter the opportunity to break laws that they don't know, because not every hunter knows what these cities of home rule charters or statutory cities that have hunting bans or discharge bans are right now. So as Joe or Josephine Hunter leave their deer camp, put their rifle in their gun rack in the back of their window, and they're driving home, they may not know if they go through one of these 90 cities that have an ordinance that prohibits the discharge of a firearm, and they will be breaking the law and possibly getting in trouble. So it's we're setting up, making things more difficult for the sportsmen and women of the state as this law becomes liberalized. And we think that that language on 2.18 to 2.26 should be deleted from the bill, so that the hunters do not have an idea that they don't know this information. It's not published in the hunting regulations. If the goal of this is to simplify things for the hunters, make sure they don't get in trouble, let's make it very simple so they can just have an uncased firearm and they can get to and from where they want to go with that firearm that's unloaded.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Meyer. That would certainly make it a little more controversial in some areas, I'm sure, too.
Well,
but,
Mr. Chair.
Then, I just represent McNamara Woods first.
Believe it.
Well, Representative Junkie,
come on, Mac.
Like you, I've dealt with it. And my kids were a generation younger, and I could not get them to quit bringing the guns to school because they would go hunting in the morning. And that our house was two blocks away from school, and I couldn't get them to swing by the house and drop the guns off because they hunted as long as they possibly could to race in. Thank goodness they put the guns in the parking lot because they would have been thrown out of school big time. But Commissioner Meyer, I actually think we have really worked hard to make this just, it's a hunting issue. When they're done hunting now, people will case their guns because you won't be able to have it through most cities, and they'll need to be in the habit of the guns being cased in Minnesota when you're not hunting. I think you would want that. And truthfully, most hunters know the city limits and such because a lot of us hunted around the edge of the city, and you generally will know it. I think hunters will assume that if you're going to travel, you better case your gun, because if you go through any municipality, your gun should be cased. I think we're trying to get here when hunters are in the field doing the things we talked about, you know, getting moved with the vehicle from one end to the other, that, you know, they're handling their gun in a safe way, but it's uncased because it's of a practical thing. I think, Commissioner, that this would be better. I know, I think they're going to know that. You know, in the metropolitan area, it's got to be cased.
Mr. Chair, members.
Mr. Meyer.
Practically speaking, to go from Deer River, you could probably drive from Deer River almost to the metropolitan area with that rifle hanging in the back of your window and not hit a city. But you don't know where those cities are. It's going to be all over the place sporadically where this is at. And I do agree, if the issue is to make sure that the hunters are not breaking the law afield, then maybe we should re-examine the language and rewrite it so it does just that. Our concern is that we're making it more difficult and more confusing for people to have an uncased, unloaded firearm now. And if the goal is to simplify things, let's just simplify them clearly.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer. I would tend to agree with the Representative McNamara on this, I guess. And I think if you're concerned about how allowing guns on school property might affect the chances of this bill passing, I think this would have that similar effect, generating more opposition to it. Representative Junkie.
Well, I'm going to go out on a limb here. I'm actually going to agree with Meyer on this one. So, but you better get on that two-line thing, too, if I'm going to start agreeing.
They would work so well.
But I do see it as one more reason to get pulled over as you're transferring, because I tend to agree, too. Especially in rural Minnesota, I agree. If you're coming back home to the Twin Cities, you're done hunting, the gun's probably cased in the trunk, and off you go. But simply traveling around the countryside while you're pheasant hunting, going into town for lunch, you know, even just transporting through a town to get to a field on the south end of town, I think you would be throwing your gun in the rack. And so somehow, and again, I don't know the answer to that. I'm not going to delete the section, but I think you do need to think about, you know, transport through these towns or within the, as part of the field experience, going from field to field. You easily could go through Wilmer, for example. I don't know if Wilmer's a non-discharge town or not, frankly, because you're right. I don't know which ones are. And, swinging from my house just out to a field. I live outside of town. I'd come into town for two blocks and be out, but the city cop then could pull me over if I just threw it in my rack to quickly transport 2 minutes away and hit the edge of town. And you're just giving... He's right in that, and I think he's trying to protect people from getting pulled over. He's still against the whole bill, and he's wrong, but that section, he's right on that.
We've changed it, I won't.
I think it's just something you need to think through as you move forward, because I think that is something I haven't thought of till just now, and I think it could happen.
Well, Mr. Chair, I have a question.
Deal.
Of the testifier, did I just hear you say that if that were resolved, that the department is for the bill and the COs are for the bill?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, members, if this language were stricken from the bill, we would probably be neutral on the issue.
Well, we went over the right direction. Mr. Chair, we went from agreeing with the bill a moment ago to now being neutral. So
it's still in there.
The liberal bill. Well, Mr. Chair, I only have one comment to that. I don't know if any of you fish up north, you have to have a New York attorney to be able to know whether you can use bait, whether you have to use a motor. whether you have to use a canoe, whether you have to have one line, whether you can use a Lindy rig and every other thing imaginable, slot limits, number of fish on a border lake, on and on and on and on. Now, hunters are not, as a rule, hunters are not going to be running around the state with their guns uncased when they're passing through cities and those types of things. I don't do that. I just don't do it. What I do is I do have it uncased when I'm afield in a state where you can have it uncased.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're trying to make this, frankly, I'd like to have that out of there too. But I know I haven't got a chance in the frozen, you know what, to get the bill passed unless I give some people some comfort language. And if I can come up with some better comfort language, I will. But, I mean, frankly, I'd like to have it wide open in the whole state because I don't think the whole thing makes sense in the first place. Uncased guns have nothing to do with the safety of the firearm. They have nothing to do with who's going to rob and who's going to act illegally, and on and on and on. We've already talked about that. But we're looking at, we spent 2 hours today working with the Police Officers Association, working on the language.
And based on your testimony, it seems that the main concern was the inconvenience of having to case the guns in the field. More so than that's what this addresses.
Mr. Chair, on that note, perhaps we can say if they're in possession of a hunting license or something like that while they're in the field, and a lot of these other changes wouldn't be necessary. That may accomplish the goal that we have. So,
and Mr. Chair?
Yeah, let's not get
there. We have been kicking that around as two members. That the problem is that farmers who don't have hunting licenses necessarily but are doing predator control are doing year-round predator control. So how do you keep writing? You just keep complicating it, you know, one step. I was really happy with just if you had a hunting license and it was valid, you could do this. But then all these other issues came up with farmers and predators. By the way, the farmers love this bill. You know, predator control and unprotected animals. You don't need a license for an unprotected animal. So that's the complication here. So we're trying to find the least complicated way to make it uncomplicated.
Okay. Okay. Any other comments or questions? Okay. I see none. So Representative Dill.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll renew my motion. House File 128 be recommended to pass and sent to public safety as the next file.
Okay. Representative Dill renews the motion that House File 128 first committee engrossment be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Public Safety. Those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Bill passes. And meeting is adjourned.